Hello from Edinburgh Castle, majestically positioned on Castle Rock, dominating the skyline of this beautiful Scottish city. I'm broadcaster Helen Prospero, and for this week's Convex Conversation, I'm delighted to be meeting up with a former colleague who just happens to be the current governor of Edinburgh Castle. Like His Majesty King Charles, Major General Alistair Bruce is a direct descendant of Robert the Bruce, the revered warrior king who fought for Scotland's independence in the 14th century. And our opening music is Governor Bruce's Ramparts, composed specially by Pipe Major Graham Ogilvie of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Pipes and Drums. Alistair is a Falklands veteran, royal confidant, and has carved out a niche putting his vast wealth of historical knowledge and expertise to use as a TV commentator, both here and for American networks. He's an author, filmmaker, and his BBC documentary Coronation featured a relaxed, intimate conversation with the late Queen, reflecting on the crowns and crowning of 1953.
He hands it that way, you see, so that I put it on when he hands it, and I put it on straight. So there are some disadvantages to crowns, but otherwise they're quite important things.
If you're eagle-eyed, you may have spotted Alistair's cameo roles in Downton Abbey, where he advised on set, and he's been involved in historical films like The King's Speech and The Young Victoria. Alistair, it is wonderful to see you again. It's a long time since I've seen you. We broadcast together live a lot on Sky News, and it was always a joy when the producer would come over on a big ceremonial occasion or a royal event and say, your presenter's friend is Alistair Bruce. I sort of wiped the beads of sweat off my brow. I was so relieved to have you by my side. Do you remember those days quite fondly, those early days of Sky?
Yes, I did. For me, it was always just such a pleasure to be guided into the process of broadcasting. I mean, I knew a lot about things, and I was fascinated by the stories behind why everything was done. But I do feel that at the beginning, you know, it was the presenters who made it all work and made sure that I didn't look a complete idiot. So thanks for that.
Really? See, we all felt the opposite, because when you were broadcasting live on a massive event, the detail that you would bring, and still bring because you still commentate, the detail you brought about what music was being played, what forces were on display, what uniforms were being worn, or what might be happening behind the scenes, just brought it to life for the viewer. And I'm just wondering where that encyclopedic knowledge comes from, where that passion for all things royal and historical comes from.
Young people get turned on and fascinated by different things, and I am convinced that if I had been interested in football, as many people are, I would have known everything about my team. I'd have known exactly where everyone was born who played in the team, and I'd have known which matches. You know, all that sort of detail gets locked into a fascinated mind, and I think for me, always understanding how the United Kingdom and its story came to be where it is meant knowing its history and understanding the constitutional arrangements that made it so. And as a monarchy, there is a great deal of intertwining with the institution of the crown itself. And so learning all that detail just came as a result. And I was fascinated watching the commentators of my childhood. And as a boy, I often used to imagine myself in situations, perhaps like a young boy who wants to be a very good footballer, will run up and down a local football field, maybe commentating himself into the part of a famous footballer. And I dare say I did much of the same. So commentating live on television was very much just an extension of my childhood enthusiasm. And actually, I think that's where people thrive and perform well. So it's never been very difficult for me to commentate.
And give us a sense, Alistair, if you would, of what your childhood was like and why for you it was these areas that you knew so much about. And was that because you, as I said in the introduction, you directly come from Robert the Bruce, that you looked into your family perhaps?
Well, I had been persuaded by my father not to cry as often as I did because I was Robert the Bruce's descendant. But that is what fathers do to encourage their sons. I was surrounded by a naval tradition, and I wanted very much to be in the Navy. And I think naval drills and the protocols that ships observe fascinated me, and I visited ships, and I was interested in how they were fought, how they carried out their contribution to national life, and how ceremonially they operated. So all of that caught my interest. And then the moment you start learning about something, it becomes more and more of a fascination as you see that you're given access to more and more areas of further research. And either you're interested in that kind of thing, which I was, or you're not, in which case you go off and do something else. But I've never stopped investigating those sort of areas.
And you're still commentating, aren't you? I mean, we still switch on the television now at a huge major event, and it's your dulcet tones that often greet us.
Well, I think that after all these years, I do know how everything is done. And people who watch an event that's about them, about the nation of which they are a part, will see visually something quite stimulating. But it's quite nice to make sure that everyone sat watching it feels that it's theirs. And the best way to do that is to make sure that what they see and don't understand, some mystery voice is putting comprehension about into their idea and understanding of what's happening. And that, I think, makes it an easier place to be as a viewer watching on television. The point about commentary is to always observe that great piece of advice that I got, which is that the key to good commentary is actually silence, and to only speak when visually the observer is seeing something that they don't necessarily understand. And you should just time your contribution to just sit at the moment they're thinking, I wonder what, oh, that's what it is. And I think that that's the game I most enjoy playing. It's different on radio because you have to paint the picture and go left to right, you know, front to rear to set up an understanding. And at the same time, always putting your arms around the viewer or the listener and bringing them into an event. But if you can make them feel that the event is theirs, that is the trick, because no one wants to feel an idiot. And the thing about the British is that they don't really know much about how Britain works. And when they witness events that celebrate Britain, they don't want to feel idiotic by not grasping what they're seeing. So if you can give them an easy access point, it's just much easier for them.
What was it like for you commentating on the King's coronation? It was a magnificent event. I think these events, Britain does better than perhaps anywhere else in the world could do this kind of thing. It looked seamless. It was stunning to watch. But how much work, Alistair, goes in behind the scenes so that you know all those little nuances and details that really bring it to life for the audience?
In various ways, we cause our parents worry. And I think in my case, it was that I made a complete set of replicas of the crown jewels aged 16 out of clay.
Did you?
And I think if you do that, you're not just trying to cut something out of cardboard. I spent hours studying the objects and recreating them. I removed a ball cock from one of the lavatories at home in order to make an orb, which I covered in gold Karamak papers. And then I put clay around it, produced the band, and then they've still survived. They're still in some semblance of reality. But I was terribly proud of them. And of course, if you are making something with an eye like I've got, which is very precise, you learn literally where everything goes. And so you see that there was a design, and I'm not satisfied in just reproducing the design, but I want to know why the arch of the Imperial State Crown is basically designed like a stream or a branch of acorns and oak leaves. So, you know, that's fascinating for me. And then you understand that that represents the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 and the survival of King Charles II in a battle where he was being pursued by Cromwell's troops. You know, all of this, it's all got stories in it. And then I suppose that is why I knew about it. And that's where my study came. But I was also asked by the Archbishop of Canterbury, because I'm an expert in Byzantine coronation ritual, which is an odd thing to be fascinated by, but to help him in the creation of the liturgy itself. And the liturgy I was excited about was taking this ancient religious ceremony and just finding ways in which to make it touchable and reachable by people who are watching the story unfold before them. And there's, for me, one object that's more interesting than any other, and hitherto it had never had a prayer associated with it. And that was the placing of a glove on the king's right hand before he was presented with the scepter of kingly power, whereas the scepter of mercy in his left hand is held with a bare hand. And the reason is because Edward the Confessor wished to remind his successors to be gentle in the use of power. So I think that's just such a wonderful example for anybody in a position of authority and leadership, and I find myself here in Edinburgh Castle doing exactly that, to remember where you have power, and everyone to some degree in their lives, be they as parents or teachers or working in a supermarket or for me as a general in the army, you are granted as a privilege power, just as the king is. And the idea that we should all put a glove on first before we take hold of our power to remind us to be gentle in the use of it, I think is emblematically powerful. And for the first time, the Archbishop of Canterbury introduced a prayer for the imposition of the glove.
Gosh, I could talk to you about those backstories all day. I just wondered how you felt, Alistair. Did you feel quite emotional that day? I know you were very fond of the late Queen, and obviously there we are watching King Charles, who's been not waiting all his life, but in readiness to at some stage take to the throne, and then you're witnessing it and sharing it with us all in great detail. Was it quite a special day, is what I'm trying to say for you?
I don't know that I felt emotion in that sort of direct personal way that you define. I think I was immensely proud of the way in which the armed forces, the church, the royal household, and every single person who contributed to the success of the event. I was so proud of what was done. I think it's fascinating that in the year 2023, the United Kingdom was anointing and crowning a sovereign. And for some extraordinary reason, it sort of wasn't questioned too much. I thought there'd be more of a sort of, what is this all about? Why are we doing it? And I know that there are plenty of people who constructively and healthily have a robust desire to turn the United Kingdom into a republic. But at the same time, you know, their voice was heard, and, you know, that's part of the joy of what the country is all about. And yet, we took our head of state back in time to descriptions that are biblical. And he was anointed just as Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet had anointed Solomon. And we watched this happen on television. And I think it was moving. And of course, when you're commentating, you've got to try and make sure that you help the viewer feel something. You don't burden the viewer with your own emotions. So you have to sort of hold it at arm's length. I think after the event, I walked, and I think because I had studied it all my life and I knew its history, almost step by step through time, I did weep, but that was quietly heading home. And I think I wept for the success of another story of our nation. And to play a very small part in it was very special. And I love being in the armed forces because I now have a medal, which is the King's Coronation Medal, which, because I was a soldier at the time, and we gave the oldest crown of the United Kingdom, which we keep here in Edinburgh Castle, we presented it to the King at a separate ceremony, along with the ancient scepter and a brand new sword that was made for the event in the High Kirk of St. Giles here. And it was just lovely to be a part of that too.
And how wonderful as well that you got the time with the Queen to make that brilliant documentary. I loved your documentary on BBC One about the crowns and her coronation of 1953. She looked so relaxed and keen to share stories. Was that a lovely thing to do?
It was a great privilege that she decided to take part in it. She has always, or had always, known that I was interested in this. And I think that my parents, who knew her and Prince Philip going right back to 1951 in Malta, knew that this particular lad, namely me, had a fascination for all of that. I think one of Elizabeth II's great strengths is she was never much interested in jewellery. She was required to wear a lot and, of course, had plenty. But I don't think she took a particular thrill in that side of her life. She just was part of the uniform, like I put on my uniform to do my job. But I think it amused her that somebody who she probably knew at a very young age was madly interested in this stuff and why and all about it. And I remember in the lull between filming the first section and the second section of our time together, I said, "Your Majesty, do you want to go back to your rooms and we'll tell you when we're..." She said, No, I'm very happy. I'll wait here and watch what you're all doing." And then she noticed some lights were on in the neighbouring room. And in the same way that my mother would have, because they were brought up in the Second World War, she went off to turn the lights off to save energy. And as we were wandering in there, she apologised to me that she couldn't really remember much about the 1953 coronation. She said, "You know, Alistair, it's easy for you. You've studied it all your life. I just had to live through it." And I've thought about that a lot since. And I suppose for the 26-year-old going on 27-year-old queen, having to get absolutely every moment of gesture and movement right in this ballet, as it was in 1953, of aristocrats moving around her who were much, much older than her, having to hold the rod of equity, hand over the sword, and whatever it might be. And I can imagine that she wouldn't necessarily remember it in the way that I don't really remember some of the events that I've had to get right. But she said that she remembered much better her father's coronation because she was just able to sit and watch it. I remember thinking, gosh, I wish we'd asked her about that.
Oh, so that was just all off camera. You didn't actually ask her about that on camera.
No.
Ah.
The household were holding very closely to the fact that Elizabeth II never gave interviews. So I've never referred to it as an interview. I refer to it as a conversation because that's what they asked me to do. And I remember when we'd done the first take and we were going through a series of clips from the coronation and I wasn't allowed to say anything that began with what, where, when, how, why. So I was only allowed to sort of say, you were very high up. And she'd then go, yes, indeed, I was very high up, blah, 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 blah. So that was interesting. And, you know, you would have found that quite difficult.
I would have found that very difficult.
Somebody like that. And I remember at the end of the first set, she said, what an extraordinary way to run a conversation. And I said, clearly her staff hadn't told her that I'd been told I couldn't ask any questions.
I feel sad in a way that I wouldn't never able to meet her. I've interviewed Prince William and various other members of the royal family, but I would have loved to have met her. I think she was something very special and quite a magnificent lady. Here we're sitting at Edinburgh Castle. I've been to the outside of the castle before, but never inside. Tell me a bit about your role, Alistair, as governor and what that entails.
There have been governors with sometimes gaps here and there since about 1107. So it's quite an old appointment. And the governor is responsible for maintaining and holding safe the principal fortress of the king in Scotland. And there has been a defensive place here probably for nearly 2,000 years. After all, it's a volcanic plug. Anybody who's been to Edinburgh, it sits right at the heart of the city. It's the sort of elephant in the city. You can't get from one side without either seeing it or having to walk around it. And so it's a natural place to build a fortress. And I'm very proud that the army in Scotland has had soldiers here for centuries. And I am immensely proud that the Scottish soldier is still performing his or her duties here in this place in support of the protection of this realm. And in essence, having been in the army myself now, in fact, for 2 days now, I've done 45 years. And I feel I'm just a part of a long story. You see, if you look at the four parts of the United Kingdom, the Scottish military story is almost more intertwined with the journey of the nation than any of the others. Our symbolism of particularly the pipes. You meet a person playing the bagpipes anywhere in the world and they're probably dressed like a Scottish soldier who is a piper. And it sort of extends this great story of military service. And the castle itself has become the foundation stone of that Scottish martial tradition. So if you believe in all the importance of what every single volunteer soldier gives when they join the armed forces of Scotland and of the United Kingdom, if you believe in that, then the privilege of being made the governor of this fortress becomes that much more powerful. And I just love the fact that I have the guardianship of that continuing relay, baton to baton, of governors going way back to the time that, you know, we can't really reach in terms of records and detail. And the fact that the oldest part of Edinburgh that was built is within the castle, which is the Chapel of St. Margaret, who, after all, was an English princess who married a King of Scots. She'd spent most of her time being brought up in Hungary, which itself is a mesmerizing thought. And all around Edinburgh, you find a number of organizations named after St. Margaret. And yet the oldest building in Edinburgh, 1130, that chapel, which even my ancestor, Robert Bruce, who knocked this castle down in 1314 because he was fed up with English garrisons occupying it. But he said to the Earl of Murray, who came to make the attack, protect the chapel. And so, you know, I go into that chapel regularly and, you know, I'm able to very comfortably walk with my own faith and to be there quietly and to think through the challenges of the day or what's on my mind is very powerful in a place where prayer has been offered up for so long. So I think the castle itself and the military story and being governor is all wrapped up with that. But my duties, well, there are four fundamental ones. I must be here to welcome the king when he comes to Scotland and to provide him a military guard when he's at Holyrood. And uniquely in Scotland, there's an appointment of somebody who becomes king for a week, and that's the Lord High Commissioner to the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. And when he comes, or she, I am there to protect them as well in exactly the same way. So that's the first two jobs. Then there's the tattoo, which is a major opportunity for the armed forces of the United Kingdom to show off their very, very best musical prowess, to bring in our allies from around the world and just put on a spectacular, at the heart of this city of culture that is Edinburgh, when it is itself immersed in both the Edinburgh Festival and the Fringe and all the glitz and excitement of that. So, you know, to be at the heart of all of that is spectacular. And to represent His Majesty here is a great honour. And to not only represent His Majesty, but to protect within the castle the ancient regalia of Scots. And you see, I believe, because I'm a romantic, that the crown of Scotland, which was made for Mary, Queen of Scots' father in the 1540s, and actually used at her coronation in 1543, that it still contains as the circlet, the very circlet that was placed by the Countess of Buchan on the head of my ancestor Robert Bruce in 1306. And because I feel that, you know, maybe it isn't, but nobody can prove the age of metal. Base metals are unageable, really. So I just find that thrilling.
And who was it originally built for or created for all those hundreds of years ago?
Well, the fortress was built to protect the people who lived in this area. Now, it may be Scotland now, but, you know, when St. Cuthbert came here, and just below the castle is St. Cuthbert's Kirk, and that's because he came from Lindisfarne and from Holy Island, which is part of Northumberland, to set up a kirk or a church at the very extremity of Northumberland. So this was part of Northumberland, which was itself a sort of kingdom in the days that he was doing his best to convert people to Christianity. So the idea of Scotland that we know today was not clear. The castle was, like many others in this part of the world, set up by the tribal unit of human beings who were trying to survive in the area, long before format came to the idea of kingship in Scotland. And so, you know, we must understand that key to this part of the country, and also the outlying parts of the Highlands where the Picts and the Scots ultimately fought together until the marriage of Jocunda, who was the daughter of the King of the Picts, with Kenneth MacAdnan, the King of the Scots. They created a union. Until then, it was not a happy place. And maybe you could say that the Highlands and Islands went on being at some loggerheads with the mainland for quite a bit, but Scotland's story is very military by nature. And that's why being part of the armed forces and having been a Scottish soldier all my life makes me feel I'm absolutely in touch with all of that.
And did that feel, that the armed forces, Alistair, really feel the right place for you all those years ago when you, well, you were Falklands veteran, so going back years there, aren't we?
Well, I wanted to be a cathedral organist.
Did you?
But I wasn't good enough, so I was a bit confused, and I wanted to then join the Navy. And my eyesight wasn't 6-6 vision, so I couldn't command a warship like my family all had. So I thought I'd then go and join the army. And I told the recruiting sergeant that I'd failed for my eye test. And he said, well, you haven't done the army eye test yet. So I said, all right. And I was down at Bovington, which is in England. And they have a tank park near where I was being interviewed. He said, let's do the army eye test. And he took me outside to the tank park and he said, stand against the wall. So I stood against the wall. He said, put your head back so you can feel the brick. And I did. And he said, cover your right eye, which I did, but I was dyslexic. Luckily, I think I got the right one. And he said, can you see the tank? So I said, well, I can touch it. He said, you're in.
And did you have happy times? Did you feel a good fit for that, given the fact it wasn't your first choice of what you wanted to do or your second?
I don't think I was a natural infanteer. That means a foot soldier. I served in the Scots Guards, which to me is one of the greatest regiments of infantry possible. although I'm now in the Royal Regiment of Scotland, and I'm equally proud of them because they inherit all the traditions of Scottish infanteering. But I just don't think I was unnatural in that area. But at the same time, you know, I pulled it off and we went to Northern Ireland, and I was with the Scots Guards when we went to the Falklands War in 1982. So all those elements of experience were part of what made me what I suppose I became. And in all of it, you know, the privilege of being with and commanding Scots, when you see them at their best, disciplined, delivering calculated, precise and legal violence in protection of their families, their land, their friends, their villages, their towns, they become the most remarkable friends. And you see them for their strengths. They know your weaknesses, and that makes collectively even greater strength as you work together. And, you know, I will leave the army at the end of this year, and I will take a treasure of memories, and will continue to try and remain supportive of and helpful to the Scottish soldier.
You've written lots of books as well, Alistair, haven't you? You've used all this knowledge to great use. You've put your historical knowledge to great use, haven't you? And spent some of the last 45 years writing too.
I like to write, but I'm told I become a bit grumpy when I'm doing it. So I've done it a little less recently. But I have been quite busy. But I think when I finish my army side, and I've only got TV and filmmaking to distract me, I probably will pick up the pen again.
We'll come on to drama and filmmaking in a moment, but I presume you've dug quite deep into Robert Bruce, given the family connection. I'm just wondering if you can indulge me in a little bit of what you discovered that would be interesting about...
I think it's almost impossible for me to know where to begin, because the thing about Robert Bruce is that he was canny. He understood that everything was against him, and he was calculated enough to know precisely when to strike for power. And that meant that he had to endure periods of being pretty uncomfortable about the situation he was in. And Scotland went through a bad time. And then when he did take the risk and took the crown, and therefore antagonized King Edward I of England, it was inevitable that there should be a crisis that would follow. And he was just cleverer than Edward II. And the way in which he fought and commanded the powerfully aggressive soldiers he had under his command, using the land, reading the strengths of what he knew against the incredible power of the English army. It's just remarkable. You know, I have been in the profession of arms for so long now that you're always looking for the advantage in a battlefield situation. And he just understood how to deploy the much more limited assets he had and still deliver victory at Bannockburn in 1314 on the 24th of June. In fact, that's why I chose to become governor here on the 24th of June. Because to me, as a Bruce, when I was given a choice of a date in June to take over, the 24th of June just sings out. So I was quite surprised I was appointed governor, because Robert the Bruce knocked the place down. And I'm the first Bruce to come and take over since. And it's still standing.
There's a wonderful irony, isn't there, that here you are as the great protector of the castle, and yet, as you say, he tried to tear it down.
But I have managed to secure one thing, and that is that my successor will be Bob Bruce.
Really?
So he takes over in September.
Really?
So I'm not gonna take accusation of having set that up, but am I happy? Yeah, I'm delighted.
You're a great filmmaker, and you've also put your knowledge to great use on dramas and sets. Downton Abbey is a series I've watched all of and loved, and you've advised Julian Fellowes on that. Tell us a bit about your role on Downton Abbey and what you would do on set for them.
Julian Fellowes married a great friend of mine, Emma, and in a way, Emma and I have been brought up together, and Julian had been asked to make an adaptation for television for children of the Mark Twain story, The Prince and the Pauper. And Emma had told Julian to get me in to help organise the coronation of Edward VI, which we did. And I think Julian watched how I did it, how I persuaded the director to understand how coronations worked, and yet still was prepared to flex enough for him to deliver his story. And I think he remembered that. And then he was given, obviously, Gosford Park came along, and then Young Victoria, and then Downton Abbey. And I think all of them had this theme where you were trying to recreate accurately a period, a time, and its protocol. And Julia knew, because we know each other very well, that I'm at comfort with all of that. And so I think he said to all the different production organizations, I will write it, but make sure Alistair's on set to deliver it. So I'm not a producer, I'm not a director, but I sit in the background as the guardian, I suppose, of the leitmotif of the time. And maybe that doesn't matter, but then Downton Abbey became an enormous, almost a phenomenon. It was so successful. So I like to think that part of that is because actually it does matter if, on the one hand, a story is speaking to the conscious, but the subconscious is also very hungry for detail. And I like to try and deliver against that hunger and place every action in the background in its time and its moment and delivered in a format that was right.
Can you give me a few examples, Alistair, of what things you might spot on set at Downton and say, actually, no, we need to tweak this or change that, or that's not how that would have been in the day?
We went into the set at Highclere Castle and they had antimacassars on the back of the chairs. Do you know antimacassars?
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I had them all removed because it was just not appropriate. And whenever there were cake stands, I had them removed because aristocratic families never had cake stands. That's what you'd find in a hotel. I think I become impossible. There was an occasion when I stopped filming because it was a very, very hot day in a very, very hot studio. And Lord and Lady Grantham were in bed together for a scene. And they had set the bed so that they were literally under just a sheet. And I said, you can't film under just a sheet. There has to be a blanket. And I think they thought I was joking. They said, look, we've already had two takes on it. We're going to just go with the sheet. I said, they would never have slept under just a sheet. They said, how can you prove that? I said, look, I'm just telling you, the beds would be set with a sheet and a blanket. Anyway, they wouldn't change it. So I went off to the producer. She was in a very big meeting and I knocked on the door and she said, I'm busy. I said, there's an issue on set. Oh, in film, if there's an issue on set, everyone with it. She said, what is it? I said, they're filming with only a sheet and no blanket. She said, my goodness, I'm coming with you. So that sort of detail did bother me. I know it's of no consequence, perhaps, but you know, if you are delivering what would have happened at the time, you deliver it as would have happened at the time.
It is a consequence, I think, because the whole point of sitting on the sofa watching these things is it's to be transported to those times. And I suppose if you're watching them eat chicken and in those days it would have been served with its feet on, perhaps, for example, you want it to be accurate. Did you get a lot of pleasure being on set of stories like Downton?
The first time we did Downton, of course, none of the cast knew who I was or who I am. And I remember Maggie Smith finding me quite difficult. I think she thought I was something that had been trodden on in the street and had ended up on her carpet. But the second season, particularly because I talked about warfare, because it covered the First World War, and I talked about how men at that time would have known war in one sense, but they wouldn't have wanted the women in their lives who were back at Downton to really understand. And I talked about warfare to both groups. And I remember, to my amazement, Maggie Smith got up at the end of my talks and she came over and gave me an enormous hug and said it had been very, very moving. I thought, nailed it. Nailed it. And actually, from that point on, I've always got on very, very well with Maggie. And I've got such profound respect for her. She is part of the filmocracy and she must be an archduchess of the filmocracy. And, you know, to work with her was a great privilege.
It was a wonderful series. You also did lots of films too. You mentioned a couple, but also like The King's Speech as well. I loved that film. How were you advising on that?
Well, I had the advantage there because my grandmother had been treated by Lionel Logue. She had had a speech impediment. And also when I was at school, I did. So I had a problem and very often still do have moments. In fact, I've noticed them happen while we've been talking. Sometimes I've tripped over a word and it's part of my impediment. Playing back and then I stopped. Did you notice?
No, I didn't.
Take a breath and then go back on it. So I was beautifully trained in that area. So I had an empathy with the period and the situation, I suppose. So in addition to that, you know, George VI, I have great admiration for because there's no doubt that Sarah Bradford, who wrote her wonderful biography, picked out a point to place on the back of the book. And she said, if a monarch can be judged by the way in which they rise to the challenges of their nation and deliver against them, then King George VI was a very great king. And I completely agree. This quiet, diffident, confidence-free individual who suddenly found himself as sovereign from 1936 as a result of the abdication of his brother, and then confronted by one of the greatest wars the world had ever seen, a confrontation between tyranny and freedom. And even his inability to speak well in public became an asset to his kingship. And the fact that Lionel Logue had helped him reach a point where, at least as king in the war, he felt able to put those communications that were listened on scratchy radios as far afield as Australia, New Zealand, across Africa, and other parts of what was then the empire. I mean, the power of the story between the king, his disability, and the overcoming of it through this amazing person, Lionel Logue. I think it was just a lovely story to get involved with. My difficulty was that the director was absolutely determined that the king should use the F word. And I said the king would never have used the F word. I mean, my grandfather, who was a friend of the king, occasionally would have said the B word, but he would never, I mean, he wouldn't dream of saying it. And the fact Tom Harper was just absolutely determined that the king would get F, 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 O, F, F, F. And I just said he would never have done it. He said, well, you know, you're the advisor, which of course I am, and we're going ahead with it. But I think if you watch the film, you suddenly are brought away from its time by that. I can see the power of it, and Tom Hooper is a great director, but I can see how he wanted it. But I think it just pulls you right out of the 1930s and throws you almost confused into the late 1990s and early 2000s.
Are you working on any other film projects? Or?
Well, we're about to make Downton Abbey 3, so.
Ah, so the film, it's the third film, isn't it?
Yes.
Not another series.
No, I think a film is what it probably requires now. And Julian, again, has come up with a tremendous script, and it's wonderful to be working on it. We're in the early stages. We don't go into production until, I think, it's about 2 or 3 weeks.
And you've had little cameos, haven't you?
I always have a walk-on part, yes. We're negotiating my one for this film.
I'm not sure that I've spotted your walk-on parts. I'm actually going to have to go back and find you. But what little cameos have you had in the
series
past?
Series one, I'm the butler to Maggie Smith. Series two, I'm the staff officer who arrives at the hospital when it's a military hospital with the general. I gave myself the military cross for that.
Did you? That's very good.
Series three, I'm a gilly up here in Scotland at the Scottish estate with a lovely beard, and I teach everybody how to dance. Series four, I'm a brigadier at the unveiling of the war memorial. I give myself the Distinguished Service Order for that. Series six, I am, is it series, I can't remember. Have I gone five? No, I haven't. I get muddled. This is my dyslexia. But anyway, then the next one, I'm the Lord Chamberlain. And I read out the names of the people coming to be presented to the king. And then finally, I'm the butler at Branksome Castle, which is actually Alnwick. And they wanted me to speak Geordie. I tried, but it was a terrible car crash. So I gave an appalling Scottish accent, for which I will never be forgiven.
I could teach you to speak Grimsby if you need any help on that front.
It'll take a lot of work, but yes, I'm always happy to try.
Sure it will. You touched on the military cross there, which brings me to a photograph on your office wall that you told me a story about when I first walked in. Tell me about that picture, Alistair, because
well,
it's a brilliant
story.
Well,
it's me pouring out a glass of champagne for someone dressed in drag, looking fabulous in a red dress and a wonderful blonde wig and a lot of makeup. And it comes from the Army at the Fringe, and the Army regularly used to put on shows during the Fringe period of the great excitement of culture and arts here in the city, which happens every August. And this was a story of immense courage of a young man who was a transvestite of his time in the 1930s, and he was recruited by Special Operations to be a radio operator working in Vichy, France. And he obviously attended a lot of theatres where he dragged up and entertained principally German troops, and he had relationships with some German officers and managed to get information from them. I imagine the courage back to England, working very closely with the French resistance, and the danger he must have faced day in, day out, not least being a transvestite in the 1930s, 1940s, and during war, but also behind enemy lines. And he was given the military cross at the end. And the story is so powerfully presented, or was at that show. I took the chief of the general staff to watch it. And I think he was as overwhelmed by, you know, it's the power of the arts. When you sit before well-performed brilliantly written drama, you cannot help but be taken to an area of thought that you hadn't even conceived before. And I find it very powerful. And, you know, it's a wonderful way of communicating that part of our history.
Certainly is. Now, since I last saw you, you married Stephen, your partner, a very long time. How is life for you both? And does Stephen come up here and spend time at the castle too?
Yes, Stephen has been a most marvellous support to me as governor. I don't think I could have done the job without him as my helpmeet. He has his own work to do, so he can't be here all the time. He's a bit younger than me, so he's got less flexibility in his career. But at the same time, he's always around when we're entertaining lots of people, particularly during the tattoo, when we probably have 24 people to dinner every other night. We have 10 people staying overnight in the castle as our guests. And we hope that with all those people who are invited, the purpose is to make sure that they come from different organizations and different businesses or whatever, or from our allies. And our task is to make their time at the tattoo excellent, in order that the life of the United Kingdom soldiers should be improved. And I couldn't do that to the degree I would like to without Stephen at my side. He makes me laugh, he makes me happy, and I love him.
Oh, that's such a lovely way to end, other than that I hadn't slipped in my last question about risk, which, as I told you earlier, we've ended every podcast in this season asking everybody what the biggest risk they've taken in life. So I just wondered what yours might be, Alistair. It's something we perhaps don't think about very often, hence the heads up on an email to put a little bit of thought in.
I always think live broadcast is a form of risk. And, you know, the whole thing of a big national event and the floor manager comes in and says 20 minutes to on air, 10 minutes to on air, and so it goes on. And I think for me, although professionally I was more than capable of, and well prepared, I hope, to cover the funeral of Diana, Princess of Wales. It was quite early in my career with Sky News, and I remember it being quite difficult to get ready because I knew Diana really well, and she was a very, very good friend. So when the floor manager said 5 minutes to go, you know, your heart starts to go a little, but you know, the army's prepared you for these sort of things. So you are ready. Then he comes and says 3 minutes, and then they come and they do the makeup and all that sort of thing. And the head of Sky News comes and says, "Are you all right?" And so I said, "Yes, I am." You know, very kind of him, but in a way, and you could sort of hear in your earpiece, "Hello, Australia, this is London. Hello, New Zealand, this is London," because Sky had a satellite capability, whereas the BBC didn't. So I knew we were going to go out to a lot of people. And then he comes and says, 1 minute to on air, 30 seconds, 10 seconds to on air, one going in, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, and then 3 fingers, 2 fingers, 1 finger, cue Alistair. And I think in terms of a major risk to be doing something, not just about a major national figure, in a time when I was conscious that whatever I was feeling, it was a personal experience for every single viewer from whatever spectrum of thought they had at that moment. And just making sure that in that risky moment, I didn't allow how I felt to get in the way. I think that was big.
How did you do that looking back, do you think?
Well, I suppose it's similar to when the late Queen died and immediately going from hearing the news to having to speak live about the Queen, her life, you know, and remembering her quite well, and then going right through to the funeral at St. George's Chapel, Windsor. You know, you deliver it. And I remember at night, we knew that at 7:30, she was going to be interred in the private chapel with Prince Philip beside her father, King George VI, and her mother, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. And obviously, we had no access to that. And I had asked Sky News to give me just a wide shot of the round tower at Windsor with the royal standard flying of the King. And I was just going to describe to people for 3.5 minutes precisely what would have been happening at that time. And I think once that had been delivered, and it was marvellous because when I finished speaking, I just told them to leave it. And the flag fluttered, and then they just melted to black and a picture of the Queen. And I remember thinking, you know, that is a job done. And after that, walking away, you feel you've served. You feel that all the training you've had has been useful, and back again to military training because it keeps you steady. But then I was free to go home. And when I got home, I closed the door and I dealt with what had happened privately.
I will share a tiny story with you about Princess Diana's funeral.
Yes.
It was actually my last day at Sky News, or Sky News the first time round.
Were we side by side?
No, I was outside Westminster Abbey and they wouldn't let me actually on air because I'd been poached to what is now Good Morning Britain, GMTV in those days. And my father was a regional newspaper editor and he'd written books about the royal family and loved the royal family, and he was invited as part of the congregation. And there I was on what was the busiest day of my life, feeding guests through the Abbey and producing the Royal Correspondent. And Dad came out with a brick of a phone and said, I've got to file my copy and I don't know how this thing works. So I broke off and I got him on the phone and he filed his copy and he looked at his watch and he said, I've got time for a quick coffee before I go back. And I was like, Dad, I can't go for coffee. This is the biggest story of my career so far and I'm in 24-hour news. And he went off quite disappointed back to King's Cross Station that his daughter on his very special moving day wasn't able to join him for a quick coffee.
But Helen, parents always find a way to just coax us back into the reality of life and remind us that however important we think something is, they just put us back into perspective, don't they?
They certainly do. It's been such a pleasure to see you again. I cannot believe all these years have passed that we've not had a coffee or a conversation. Thank you so much for making me really welcome to the castle, sharing some lovely stories and lovely memories.
Well, thank you for clambering up to the finest fortress in the United Kingdom.
Well, I'll be clambering down shortly. You've been listening to Major General Alistair Bruce talking to us from the magnificent Edinburgh Castle about the many roles he fulfills. Download our podcast at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple and Google Podcasts or wherever you listen to yours. I'll be back next week deep in the bowels of London's Natural History Museum to find out why now is a golden age for dinosaurs and hear more about the latest discoveries with one of the world's leading paleontologists. So join me then.